You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, my name is Kristen Turner, and I'm the host of New Books in Music, part of the New Books Network. Today, my guest is Catherine Preston, author of a magisterial new book from Oxford University Press, Opera for the People, English Language Opera and Women Managers in Late 19th Century America. Today, we might think of opera as elite art music enjoyed only by snobbish classical music fans, or perhaps wealthy philanthropists looking to solidify their status in high society. But in this book, Preston demonstrates in painstaking, exquisitely sourced detail that opera was middle-class entertainment in the second half of the 19th century, especially European operas and operettas performed in English translation by itinerant opera companies that traveled throughout the United States, bringing opera to big cities and small towns, wherever there was a railroad station and a theater. And if that's not surprising enough, many of the most important opera companies Preston studies were managed by women. Preston's book provides the first complete overview of the repertoire, companies, performers, and managers that performed English language opera to Americans after the Civil War. Welcome, Dr. Preston. I'm so happy to talk to you today about your new book.
Well, thank you for having me, Kristen. I'm really delighted to be here. It's an exciting book, and I would like a lot of people to know about it.
Well, I think it is an excellent book and certainly quite a magnum opus. It's an incredible research accomplishment as well as writing accomplishment. So how did you decide on the topic for this book? I know you have written before on opera and English translation, but why this book right now?
Well, it's a bit of a long story. I'll try to condense it. A number of years ago, I wrote a book on itinerant opera companies in the United States in the antebellum period, that is the 1820s to 1860. And when I wrote that book, the general knowledge among Americanist music historians was that opera was not very popular in America during this period. People didn't know about it, and it was certainly something that was for the elite and the aristocrats and wealthy people. Well, in the process of my research, I discovered that, in fact, there were lots and lots of opera companies that were itinerant companies. They were touring all over the United States, that is, all over the eastern half of the United States, because the Transcontinental Railroad didn't go through until after the war. And they were part of the mainstream American popular stage. So lots of people, not just wealthy people, lots of people went to these opera productions, and it became an important part of American popular culture. So I stopped at 1860, and then I thought, well, let's do something else. But I kept wondering what happened, because I had created this image of this incredible wealth of activity on the operatic stage in America in the 1850s. And then when the story gets picked up again by American historians, which is in the 1880s and 90s, opera has become exclusive and not part of the popular theater. And I wanted to know, how do we get from where we were in the 1850s to where we are today, where in which opera is in fact a kind of an aristocratic, elite, expensive niche market. So I wanted to figure out, how do we get from popular theater to niche market? And so I decided to start looking at just the English language style of opera production, because I figured that if I'm starting in 1850 and there's huge numbers of companies, when I get to the 1870s, it's going to be impossible to write about. So I decided to focus on English language opera and started looking. And it was amazing what I discovered very quickly, that in fact, English language opera, that is opera performed in English, not necessarily English composers or American composers, but the continental composers, having their works performed in English for the American stage, they had not disappeared at all. In fact, they were a major part of our own cultural history. And that's how, I mean, I kind of accidentally got into it. But it bore a lot of fruit, because I've discovered that there were lots of companies. And then coincidentally, I discovered that many of the more successful English language opera companies were managed by their prima donnas or impresarios who were women, which was extraordinarily eye-opening for me, because our image of women in the 19th century is that they're staying in the home, taking care of the kids, raising kids, and so on and so forth. This flies against all of our received knowledge about what women were doing in the 19th century.
So that was different. In the early period, you didn't have as many women managing as you do later on. Is that correct?
Yeah, things were different in the late 19th century from the early 19th century. When I did the research for the earlier part of the century, there was one or two exceptions, but most of the companies were run by men, theatrical managers and impresarios, and it was a male-dominated field. There were a handful of women. This changes in the late 19th century, and I think because operatic reception becomes bifurcated by about the 1870s. When you look at what's going on in the 1850s, you have English language opera there were companies that were performing in English. You also had what were known as Italian companies. Now, the repertory these companies performed was continental. It was French, it was German, but it was sung in Italian. And so the difference was the Italian companies and the English companies. And the English companies were predominantly popular theater. Increasingly, as the 1850s go on, the Italian language companies become more expensive and more exclusive. Okay, so you're starting to see this beginning of a bifurcation in terms of reception. When you get to the postbellum period, the critics are all saying, "Oh, English language opera is so passé; it is so old-fashioned. We need to support the Italian language company." And what happens in the 1860s is there are a number of women impresarios or singers who think, "Hey, this is not true. There's still a market out there for English language opera, and we'll just make our own companies." And so this is the very beginnings of a renaissance of English language opera in the United States in the 1860s and then into the 1870s. And so what is happening in the postbellum period is that women who are not part of the Italian language world, or they can't break into it because they're not foreign, decide, forget this, we're not even going to try to butt our heads against this wall, we're going to just go and make our own companies. And so they create this whole other kind of substrata of English language opera performance that becomes extraordinarily popular, but they're doing it kind of outside the mainstream.
So just to be clear for our audience, can you talk about exactly what the repertoire was? When you say English language opera, are you talking about operas originally written in English, or are you talking about operas written in other languages and in translation?
Both. Mostly the latter. Mostly English language operas consist of compositions that are the standard continental repertory. In the 1870s and 80s, it's Verdi, and it's Auber, and it's Meyerbeer and other really important Gounod. So all of those major operas that are on the Italian stage or in the French stage in France or in Italy are being sung in Italian by the Italian companies in America and in English by the English companies in America. The English companies also perform the handful of operas by William Vincent Wallace or trying to think of other names of these composers. I'm kind of blanking
out. Michael Balfe.
Balfe was major composer. So there were some English or British composers who were writing opera, and a couple of Irish composers as well, who were writing opera in English. And the English language companies in America performed their operas, but they primarily performed the operas that were from the continent.
So, of course, that brings up the question about why weren't they performing opera by American composers? Why move to translated continental pieces or pieces by British and Irish composers?
Well, that is actually quite a good question, and it's one that I'm not sure I have the answer to, except that I suspect it's marketing. The English language companies knew a good thing when they saw it. They knew that Americans loved opera. They continued to love opera in the 1870s, 80s, and into the 90s. They liked the opera that was continental opera. That was all of the buzz was around these operas that were coming out of France and Italy, and then a bit later out of Germany. And so there was a market for them in English translation. There were actually quite a few American composers who were writing operas. There were something like 25 or so whose names and whose operas showed up in a list in a journal in the United States in around 1885. There was a kind of a controversy about one particular opera company, and American critics were going, why aren't they singing American composers? And the response was, well, there aren't very many American composers and nobody knows their works. Well, this editor put together a list of about 25 American composers who had actually written operas. It's the same kind of problem that American composers of orchestral music faced or chamber music faced, in that music, the classical style of music was, people looked to Europe for that rather than to Americans. And American composers had a really, really hard time breaking in and getting their works performed. And it's the same problem with on the operatic stage as it was
Is this a large repertoire of operas, or are we talking about really just sort of a handful that are performed over and over?
Well, it depends on the company. And now we get into a whole other subset of complications, in that if you look at what operas were being performed on the American stage in the 1870s, 80s, and into the 90s, you have a continuum of different styles of opera, starting on the high end, in quotation marks, where companies are called grand opera companies. These are grand English opera companies. And the repertory there was primarily the standard operatic repertory from the continent, plus a couple of English language operas. Then below that, you have what are known as comic operas. And those companies are performing more of the lighter operas from the continent and English operas. And they're also including in their repertories operettas, which become extraordinarily popular in the 1860s in this country. And then below that you have just operetta companies that are performing Gilbert and Sullivan and Franz von Suppé and all sorts of other operettas that are either written in English, like the Gilbert and Sullivan ones, or written in German or French, and then translated into English. And then below that, on the very bottom of this continuum, you have opera companies that are performing burlesques of operas. And that gets into the whole variety stage, which I don't get into, but that's kind of a that's an area where there's a lot of overlap between variety and these burlesque opera companies. So to your question, Kristen, when you're looking at the top two tiers, the comic opera companies and the grand opera companies, these are all in English, they were singing primarily translations of European works. And and some of the companies are small and they have maybe 8 or 10 operas in the repertory. Other companies were large and they had upwards of 30 or 40. Now, having an opera in a repertory and performing it regularly are two different things. But I think it's important to point out that even this late in the 80s and into the early 90s, opera companies in America were performing different operas every night. Rather than what we have today, which is, you know, an opera season that has 5 operas in it, perhaps, and the operas are performed for a stretch of a couple of weeks or something, and before you go on to a new production. In the 19th century, the demands on the singers was pretty extraordinary, and they performed lots and lots of operas over and over again.
You've sort of painted a picture of a lot of companies performing a particular repertoire of mostly European works. Who are they performing for? Who's the audience?
Let me take as an example two companies that were fairly long-lived. The first is Caroline Riching's company. She was a British-born but American-raised singer, raised on the stage. And she was kind of the architect of the renaissance of English language opera in America. She went against the critics and said, no, there is an audience for this repertory. And she started to sing operas and produce operas in the 1860s during the war and then after the war. And her heyday was in the late 60s. That company is kind of juxtaposed with Emma Abbott's company. This is a company that got started in 1879 and went through until 1891 when Abbott died very suddenly. Both of those companies were geared toward an audience comprised of middle-class Americans with some upper-class and wealthy Americans thrown in. But both Riching's, who was actually, as I said, was raised on the stage. Her adopted father in America was Peter Riching's, who was a theater manager and an actor. She grew up on the stage, and so her world as an opera singer was within the context of the American theatrical world, okay? And that audience was not as bifurcated or niched as it becomes in the 1890s. So in the 1860s and 70s, it's still a fairly homogeneous audience, probably ranging from maybe some working class people, probably not so many, but mostly professional people, and going up from there. So what we would think of today as the middle class, which of course is a kind of a very difficult term to define. Okay, so Riching's is in the 1860s and early 1870s. Her audience is primarily a theatrical audience. When you get about a decade later with Emma Abbott, she's trained in Italy and in France. She is an American. She was born in Peoria, Illinois. And her audience is overtly middle class. She and her husband, who is her theatrical manager, were brilliant at marketing their opera. And they deliberately marketed it toward middle-class people who wanted entertainment. They weren't interested in edification or uplift or anything like that we tend to associate opera with today. They were interested in entertainment and spectacle and beautiful singing. And both Emma Abbott and her husband, Eugene Wetherill, were very much attuned to that, and they sold their opera to the middle class. This does not mean that upper class people did not go to these performances, but in fact, I think they did. It's just that the primary audience was middle class Americans like us, people who would go to musical theater today or to movies even. It wasn't the upper classes that they were aimed at. Now, when you get into the 1880s, you have a whole different company, which is the American Opera Company, 1885, 86, 87. And that was well-funded, and it was supposed to be aimed at the middle or at the upper classes. And that one didn't work, but that's kind of a different story from what your question was about.
Actually, now that you bring up the American Opera Company, maybe this would be a good time to switch and talk a little bit about particular companies. And you also brought up Emma Abbott, who, of course, is a very important figure, both in your book and, of course, historically. So maybe I'd love you to talk a little bit about the American Opera Company. It did fail very quickly, and its failure had such a long-lasting impact on opera in America. I'd love for you to let our listeners know a little bit about that company and why it was particularly such an important moment in American operatic history.
Well, that's a big question, Kristen. Let's see, where do I start? The American Opera Company looms large in our historiographic understanding of English language opera in America because it is the only opera company that performed in English that before my book was known to American scholars. There were a couple of articles, three articles actually written by a scholar a number of years ago about the American Opera Company. It had some pretty major players involved. And in fact, I'll tell you the major players. Jeanette Thurber, who was the woman who eventually created a conservatory in New York, and she brought over Antonin Dvorak to this country in the 1890s. So she's very well known for that. And the other person involved was Theodore Thomas, who was a major American orchestral conductor, who is his nickname is America's Conductor. He was a proselytizer, an educator, and very much wanted American to teach American about good music. I put good music in quotation marks. By good music, he meant German music, German symphonic music. So those two people were involved in the creation of they were very much involved in the creation of the American Opera Company, and they are very well known to scholars for other reasons. So there has been some focus on the American Opera Company in American music history textbooks because these people were involved. And what has happened is that the company failed absolutely dramatically. They ran through millions of dollars of money, and they just utterly failed for a variety of reasons. I won't go into all the reasons, but the upshot of that is that the scholars who have done work on the American Opera Company have concluded years ago that they failed because Americans didn't want Italian or English language opera. Americans were not interested in English language opera. And so that failure and that, as far as I'm concerned, misinterpretation of the reasons for its failure have dramatically colored American historians, music historians' reception of or interest in English language opera, because the answer was there. Americans were not interested in English language opera. So I'm working on this particular book, and I keep running up against the American Opera Company, and I'm thinking, well, I really don't want to write a chapter on the American Opera Company because it's been done. But the conclusions I finally decided were all wrong, because I was finding, for example, the Emma Abbott Opera Company and the Boston Ideal Opera Company, who were operative right around the same time as the American Opera Company, and they were making money hand over fist. So I thought, all right, I need to dig into what was going on with the American Opera Company and find out what went wrong. In a nutshell, what went wrong is a misunderstanding of the nature of the American opera for English language. A misunderstanding of the makeup, the nature of the American audience for English language opera. The audience was middle class. It was interested in entertainment. It was not interested in elitism or edification or education. They wanted to go to the theater the same way we want to go to the theater to see spectacular stuff. Beautiful scenery, like we see special effects in the cinema. Beautiful singing. They were interested in entertainment. And when Jeanette Thurber hired Theodore Thomas to be the artistic director and the conductor of her opera company. She raised all the money. She was a philanthropist, and she had connections in the among the wealthy people in New York. That was her crowd. She raised money from those people, and then she hired Theodore Thomas. And Theodore Thomas, who was really at heart a Germanophile, who wanted to teach Americans about good opera, in which case we're talking Wagner, basically changed the kind of the orientation of the company to something like what the Italian companies were trying to do, and that is focus their marketing attempts and their marketing efforts on a particular class of people who were wealthy, people who were interested in edification, and so on and so forth. And it failed spectacularly. It was just amazing. And I blame Theodore Thomas, and I blame Jeanette Thurber, I think, is probably less to blame, although she was pretty profligate with her spending, and they went through millions of dollars, and the company was bankrupt within 18 months. It was a scandal, and because it was such a high profile company that had the attention of all the critics and lots of other people, it kind of poisoned the water for any other subsequent attempt to create a really, really well organized, high paid, you know, prima donnas and so forth, a well organized company that could present English language opera in a way that was similar to what was being presented at the Met, that is, the Italian companies or the Italian or German performances at the Met. The American Opera Company was intended to be kind of an English language counterpart to that. And they had the funding, and they just completely misunderstood the opera audience. So it failed, and it has had a kind of ripple effect in our understanding of English language opera up until the present day.
I'm thinking about perhaps we should explain a little bit about the bifurcation of the audience that you were alluding to as part of the reason that the American Opera Company failed. So you have the middle class audience going to English language opera, but there's also opera being performed in Italian, a little bit of opera being performed in French, opera being performed in German. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what audiences, well, let me ask this a different way. They have different audiences, but also why do they have different audiences? Why does the language of performance make a difference?
Well, I'm not sure that it is language of performance. Boy, Christian, it's such a complicated question because it's such a complicated situation. What we think about today in terms of opera, I mean, let's do it this way. Opera, you know, opera today is, for the most part, considered elite and aristocratic and expensive and so on and so forth. And it answers to a niche market. OK, things are changing with the Met broadcasts and so forth. But in reality, the sense among most Americans is that opera is a very esoteric kind of entertainment. Musical theater, on the other hand, is something that people go to. There are kids performing musical theater in high schools, and there's lots of musical theater. I'm talking about American, you know, Rodgers and Hart and Rodgers and Hammerstein and Lerner and Lowe and Cats and so forth. People know musical theater. They love musical theater. Many people do, in any case. And that's in English, and that's a different style. And so those are the two, that's a bifurcation in the 20th century. That started in the 19th century. And what I was trying to do in this book is try to tease out this the different strands of this large ball of yarn, and there's all these different colors in it, and try to pull them out and try to figure out what happened when and how this all got to where we are today. So the English language companies in the 1880s and into the 90s are basically the precursors to our musical theater today. The Italian language companies and increasingly the German language companies are the precursors to what we have in terms of, the Met opera companies today. Now, within the Italian and German companies and within that audience that they are going to, there are also subsets. And this is where it kind of gets complicated, because the Italian companies were really pushing the idea of elite and aristocratic and wealthy. In other words, it's the ostentatious display of wealth that is associated with opera in the 80s and into the 90s. Is this making sense? So
oh yes.
Okay. So if anybody who's read Edith Wharton's Age of Innocence, and we have this portrayal of these wealthy New Yorkers and the nouveau riche who are fighting against the old cliff dwellers and so forth. That particular book opens with a scene at the Academy of Music, and the performance is of Gounod's Faust in Italian. And what we're focusing on in the book is what's happening in the galleries, but in the boxes, and how the wealthy are using that performance or going to that performance as a marker of their wealth. Okay, so they were interested, as the wealthy people who were going to Italian language companies were interested in using opera as a way to separate themselves from the masses who are going to English language opera. But they were interested in entertainment, so they would sometimes go to the English language companies. Okay, now you get the increasing numbers of German language companies and the appearance of Wagnerian music drama. And Wagnerian music drama is the antithesis of Italian language opera, or Italian opera for that matter. Italian opera is about drama, it's about melodrama, it's about, you know, human nature, and it's about beautiful singing. The German opera during this period, especially Wagner's music dramas, are about edification and uplift and education and culture and sublimity. And so when you have German language, we have, by the 1880s, we start to have in America these people who are real Wagnerians, and they want to wrest the operatic stage from people who are interested in entertainment, whether they're the wealthy going to the Italian companies or the lower class or middle class going to the English language companies. They want people to learn to use opera as a way to reach the sublime. Okay, so that is a very, very different audience than even the Italian language companies and their aristocratic audiences. So when the Metropolitan Opera went from in Italian language performances to German language performance and a German language repertory, many of the people in the box holders and at the Met really didn't like it. They didn't want the German language because they were not interested in uplift and sublimity. They didn't want culture. They wanted entertainment. So you have a very complicated mixture of different kinds of audiences, different marketing techniques, and different types of repertory. So it hasn't really essence to do with the language so much as the style of opera. There's a very different style between Wagner's music dramas and the number operas, even of Verdi and Puccini and later. But it's mostly what the function of opera is supposed to be. Is that complicated enough?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, it is obviously complicated. And I think would surprise people today who sort of see opera as this monolith and it doesn't really matter the style or the language or where it's being performed or anything. It's just this upper class thing and this sort of elite entertainment. And it's obviously very different in the time period you're talking about. So I'd like to get back some to, you spoke about Jeanette Thurber and her role as a philanthropist and someone who was sort of dedicated to art music in America, both in the opera company. And then, of course, she founded her own conservatory and brought Dvorak here, and et cetera. But I'm wondering about some of the other women in your book who are so important, the Emma Abbott and Carolyn Richings and others. How could you tell the difference between a woman who was really running her own company and a woman who was just the prima donna for a particular company and got most of the marketing? So there's a lot of marketing energy behind her as a prima donna.
Well, it's actually pretty easy because if you look at the advertisements, Caroline Richings is identified as the directoress. She made up that word, I think. And Emma Abbott was clearly the musical director of her company. Her husband, Eugene Wetherill, was the business manager. Clara Kellogg, someone who you haven't mentioned, was kind of in between both Richings and Abbott in terms of time frame. Kellogg was very active in the 1870s, and she makes no bones about the fact, and she wrote a memoir, she makes no bones about the fact that she had been singing in an Italian language company, and the manager of the company was actually also the manager of one of the several prima donnas in the company. And so he was putting all of his energy into promoting this other prima donna. And so as a result, on the nights when that prima donna was singing, the houses were full. On the nights that Clara Kellogg was singing, the houses were empty. And so she lost her job at the end of the season, at which point she said, to hell with you guys, I'm going to make my own opera company. And she made her own Clara Louise Kellogg Grand Opera Company. And she was the manager. She hired a business manager to take care of the contracts and the bookings and so forth. But she made all of the decisions. And I could say this about all three of these women. They made all of the decisions as artistic directors. They hired people, fired people. Several of them, most of them, I think, made their own adaptations of the Continental Opera, translating them into English. They made decisions about what repertoire was being performed. It's pretty clear from the evidence that this was going on. So you look at the playbills, you look at the advertisements, you look at if there's any interviews, you look at memoirs. I mean, as I said, Kellogg wrote her own memoirs, and Emma Abbott was, as I said, she was a brilliant marketing person. She and her husband both, and she gave interview after interview after interview in newspapers, which some people said, oh, well, she's just selling out to the general public. I'm using a 20th century term there, but she knew that if she created an identity for herself as someone who was a girl next door, who was, in fact, what she was called was the people's prima donna, that would bring people out to her audiences. So it's pretty clear from the evidence that you look at that who was in control in terms of the artistic direction of the companies.
How did people respond to that? I mean, you mentioned at the very beginning of this interview that it surprised you that there were so many lady managers, as you call them in the title of your book, and that these women clearly were in charge of the artistic direction and sometimes even the business management of their own opera companies. How did people respond to that, whether they're their audience or critics? Did they get a lot of pushback for that?
Well, actually, I sort of expected to find pushback, and I looked for some. I didn't find it. Caroline Richings, for example, was a favorite. The critics really, really liked her, and they're calling her our Caroline Richings. She is this Iron Woman. She can do anything. She can hire and fire singers. She can get up in front of the orchestra and conduct the whole performance if she needs to. And there's perfectly good anecdotal. Well, I think not anecdotal, but stories of her actually doing that. One time, one of her conductor, whoever it was, I can't remember at the moment, was sick and couldn't conduct the orchestra, and she got up and did it herself. So there was a to my point of view, of surprising acceptance of this. Now, I should point out that with Richings in particular, there was she was working within the realm of the theater. And there is a strong tradition in this country and in England as well of women theatrical managers. Most of them tended to be the wives of theatrical managers who died, and they took over the contracts, but then subsequently found themselves in this situation and did very well. So when with Richings coming out of that world where she knew some theatrical managers, her father was a manager, as well as a performer, that it was kind of a fairly simple transference for her. Okay. So the critics were warm to her and accepted her. The only time I saw pushback was one time she got into a legal case with a singer who had broken a contract, and she fell back on the argument that women couldn't sign contracts, which was the case. I mean, married women in particular during this period were not legally allowed to sign contracts. Their husbands had to sign them for them. And she fell back on that argument, and the judge threw the case out. And he said, you know, this is ridiculous. He didn't say this, but he was quoted as saying in the newspaper account that Ms. Richings has for so long acted in a managerial fashion that for her to make this argument against one of her singers is ridiculous. And he threw the case out. In terms of Emma Abbott, I never saw any pushback. I mean, I saw pushback from other forces. For example, so many of the American critics in the 1880s were born again Wagnerians. They really, really wanted to push the whole Wagnerian idea. And so they didn't like what she was doing, because what their goal, and I'm generalizing ridiculously here, but their goal was to follow Wagner's lead and make opera into a sublime, edifying, uplifting experience, and get it out of the gutters, as they would have put it, that it was just, you know, mere entertainment. And here was Emma Abbott, at the same time they're making this argument in support of the American Opera Company, here was Emma Abbott making money hand over fist by giving to the audiences what they wanted, which was entertainment. Okay, so she got a lot of pushback in that way, but I never saw her being criticized for being a woman manager. In fact, there's some evidence of women suffragettes or women's rights supporters in Chicago, for example. There was a woman who wrote a regular column for women's rights in the Chicago Inter-Ocean, a pretty major newspaper, and Abbott was just getting started, and she was coming from New York, and this columnist called out to her sisters and said, "You must support this woman because she is a strong woman and she is bucking the system and we need to support her." So Abbott got support from women's rights people, and she created part of her image was the idea of allowing women to raise themselves up by their bootstraps the same way men could do. So she felt that I don't think she worked in the whole area of suffragette in that movement, but she certainly believed that women could stand on their own two feet. So I saw no evidence of people saying, "Well, what the devil is she doing? She should be in the home." Because I guess because she was an actress, or you know, she was on the stage and things were changing. The other one that I think is worth pointing out, again, no sense of pushback that I've seen, is a woman named Effie Ober, who I've not mentioned yet. She was not a performer; she was just a manager. And she got her start as the independent manager owner of a concert management firm in Boston in the early 1870s. She was managing singers. Her whole background is from the Lyceum movement. But I think she was a young woman in the early 1870s. So she saw the whole change in what women did in the greater workforce that was caused by the Civil War, right? I mean, it's the same thing that happened in World War II, where women got out of the home and went into the factories because the men were off fighting. This was happening in the Civil War as well. At the end of the war, many of the women were happy to go back to being, you know, working on the farm or raising their families if they were middle-class women in urban areas, while as the men became the, you know, the breadwinners and so forth. But many women thought, no, I don't want to do that anymore. I want to continue being a wage earner and being my own boss. And so Effie Ober was one of those women. I think she was very much influenced by what happened during the war. Furthermore, as someone who was in the Lyceum movement, which is a lecture kind of bureau where you're organizing lectures for people who are going around to various parts of the country and giving lectures, many of the people in the Lyceum movement were women, the suffragettes, women who had worked in the sanitary fair movement during the Civil War, and so Effie Ober knew all of these women, and I think as a young woman growing up, she knew these people because she was working with them. She saw what had happened during the Civil War, and she decided, well, I'll just create my own management firm. And from that came the Boston Ideal Opera Company, which she created and managed from 1879 to 1885. And then she bowed out, and then that company became the Bostonians, which went on until 1904. So it had a long career. So there are three different women, four I can mention. I didn't see any backlash. I looked for it. I could not find it.
Well, do you think then that this is just because they were already out in the public sphere and they were people just accepted that women on stage were sort of a different category of woman, so to speak, and so it was okay that they had such a public role? Or do you think what you've really found is evidence that women were not as professionally stunted as we might assume in the 19th century?
I would say both. Things were changing in American society. They weren't unilaterally accepted. There's no question of that. I mentioned Emma Abbott and her pushback from the Germanophile critics. She also had pushback from churches. That they felt that she was she and women on the stage. Some churches felt that she and women on the stage were immoral and they should not be allowed to do this. There was a perfect example of this in the case of Abbott. She was on tour in Tennessee. I can't remember if it's Nashville or Memphis. And she actually was a very moral, upright, very proud of her monogamous marriage. She went to church every Sunday, wherever she was on tour, because performers didn't perform on Sunday. She would walk out of the hotel wherever she was and walk down the street. And the first church she came to, she would go to that service. So she was she had a very Catholic kind of inclusive attitude toward organized religion. And she went into a church in Memphis, I think. And the sermon that day by a new minister was about the fact that the city had opened a new theater in the city, and the Emma Abbott Opera Company had been the first performers. And the whole sermon was about the immorality of women on the stage. And Abbott, astonishingly, she was sitting in the back and nobody noticed where she was, astonishingly got up at the end of the sermon and said, there are good ministers and there are bad ministers. There are good people on the stage. There are bad people on the stage. And just created this incredible furor all over the whole country. The wire services picked up this story and about this whole thing. And then they interviewed Abbott and she said, I can't think of a better way to serve God than for a woman to work and send the money back home to her children. I mean, many of her choristers in her company were New Yorkers, and they sent their money back to their kids in New York. Some would probably say they should be staying home with the kids, but this was how they could make a living. And so I don't want to suggest that there was no pushback, but the fact I never saw anything about these four women front in the press about, oh, they have no right to be on the stage, or they have no right to be out in public. So things were changing. They were changing slowly. So that part of the equation is there. But I think they were changing in part because women were out there in the workforce and were doing stuff that we have forgotten about. We don't know this. So I think the answer is both.
We've talked a lot about companies so far that were mostly active in the 1870s, 1880s. Of course, Emma Abbott could have been active much longer, but she died very suddenly in 1891. But you end your book with one last company or group of companies that actually is run by a man, Henry Savage. And I wonder if you could sort of round out the story here and talk a little bit about what were the challenges he faced. He seems to have had a slightly different economy that he was working within than the earlier companies you've talked about. And he actually ran his company a little bit differently as well.
Well, he certainly did. And you certainly know about the Castle Square Opera Company as well. I think the major difference and the reason I end with Henry Savage, well, I end with him and I end with the Bostonians as well, is because by the 1890s, English language opera had become such an important part of American theatrical culture, and Italian and German language companies had shrunk in terms of their outreach, in terms of their audience. It's a real picture of niche marketing. By the time you get to the 90s, the Italian, the foreign language companies were now almost uniformly identified, I'm getting on thin ice here, as aristocratic elite and so forth, either culturally elite or economically elite. And so the market for that style of opera, unlike the market for the same style in the 1850s, had completely shrunk. So it's really a niche market. English language opera in all of its manifestations, ranging from burlesque opera up through grand opera, had become really, really important and really a major part of American popular theater that would then create an audience, or had created an audience that would segue into American musical theater at the beginning of the 20th century. So it's no longer marginalized. English language opera has become popular theater, and men wanted to get back in on it. So what had been a market that was marginalized and that women took advantage of in the 1860s, 70s, 80s had now become popular theater. It was no longer a marginalized market, and men wanted back in. Does that make sense?
Of course.
Okay. All right. So Savage is working in a realm that is very different than what Emma Abbott was working in, or Caroline Richings and so forth. And he actually was pretty smart. He understood how American tastes were changing, and he threw his lot in not just with English language opera, which is the same, it's the same kind of repertory, although there's now a newer repertory that is from Europe and is being translated into English, but also some of the older repertory. But also, in addition to that, he was interested in the new emerging musical theater. He worked with Jerome Kern. He had his fingers in multiple pots, including working with early film music. So he was brilliant in terms of understanding the market, and so he's a great transition into the 20th century. Now, I end my story at the beginning of the 20th century with kind of like an epilogue about what's going on, how things had changed. It's up to somebody else, and there are some people now working in this area, including you, who are looking at what's happening at the beginning of the 20th century and how we get from there to where we are today, or where we were in, say, about the 1950s and so forth. So things are dramatically changing. American audiences now are they're losing their interest in operetta. Even Gilbert and Sullivan, they're looking for upbeat music. They're looking for music where you can dance to it. They're looking for slang. They're looking for topical kinds of stories. This is not the operetta mold, nor is it the English language opera mold. So my sense is, to a great extent, these opera companies served a major purpose in terms of creating it. Well, they were major entertainment in America in the 19th century. And then when you get to the 1890s, they become kind of a transition, that people are moving away from the old older style of opera that had been so prominent in the 70s and 80s, and moving into newer styles of comic opera or musical comedy or musical theater. And those terms are emerging in the late 19th century. I mean, there's all sorts of different kinds of terms, because in reality, that period was a period of incredible flux. Henry Savage figured that out, and he survived the change by actually kind of coasting along the top of it and giving the audiences exactly what they wanted in various different venues. In contrast, you didn't bring this up, but I'll finish out this way. In contrast with the Boston Ideals, which are now called the Bostonians, who had become, after Effie Ober left the company, had become the major comic opera company in America. They were universally renowned, and they gradually moved in the direction of all operetta. And in fact, the company commissioned operettas by Victor Herbert and by Reginald de Koven. These are American composers. They didn't see the change. They were old-fashioned. And by the 1890s, well, the late 1890s and the beginning of the century, they were still interested in operetta, and the audience was disappearing. And they basically, they ended up their careers in 1904, after 25 years, they had to close down the company because the audiences were gone. Whereas the Castle Square Opera Company was still going very strong into the 1920s. Am I right? 1930s? How long did Savage go? Do you remember?
Well, Savage stopped performing opera, like grand opera, in English in 1911. But he was an active producer on the Broadway stage, and then moving those around in tour until his death, which I was in the 20s sometime. He didn't live as long as some of those others from that period. But he sort of got away from grand opera and into, like you were saying, operetta, and then straight musical comedies, and then on into film. He sort of did everything. And I think one reason for that is he was able to see more clearly what was happening in the market is that he wasn't a singer. He was a businessman, whereas the Bostonians were being run by their own singers. And I think that they must have had a very different idea of the market, because they were thinking about what could they sing, what could they perform. And Savage was really putting together companies that were going to make money for him, no matter whether he was, you know, whether it was an English translation of Parsifal, or if it was The Merry Widow in English translation, or, you know, a Kern operetta. So he definitely had a really different vantage point, I think, that really helped him be so much more successful than some of these other singer managers who seem to have a more narrow view.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about how he got into the whole business accidentally. I mean, he just kind of fell into it. So that's pretty interesting. And he turned out to be the man for the job.
Yeah. Anyway.
But I think the next story, the next part of this saga, is to understand what I mean, what you're working on right now is opera in on the vaudeville stage, right? Or in the variety stage?
Yes, and in musical comedies. Yeah,
right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
There are some other people out there working on opera on the Chautauqua stage and opera in other areas of the country that are into the 20th century, which is actually quite useful because I stop at basically at 1900, 1904 thereabouts. I mean, the book was long. The book was big enough as it was. It didn't need to go into the 20th century. So,
well, it's certainly a much needed book. I think there's nothing else out there that has even begun to provide as much information as you have on so many different people, so many different companies, and really surveying, like you said, the whole country. It's very difficult to do that. And no one had even attempted it before you. And so I think it's going to be a book that's going to, you know, people are going to be using for years to understand what was happening in American culture in the second half of the century.
Well, thank you. I hope so. It's a major hole, and I've begun to fill it. So took a long time, but now it's done.
Well, that of course brings me perhaps to my last question, which is, now that you have finished this enormous project, what are you working on? What can we expect to see from you next?
Well, I jumped right into a new book because I just retired from the College of William and Mary, where I've been teaching for almost 30 years. And the new book is a biography of an American composer named George Frideric Bristow, who most people have never heard of. But it turns out that he was regarded as the most important classical musician in America during the 1860s and 1870s. And I say that, I say that not because I'm running a biography of him, but because in all of the newspaper research I've done and periodical research I've done, I keep coming across this description of him as our American composer or the most important American composer. There are these comments that are just kind of asides. So this is something that we don't know about. I don't know what happens to his reputation in the 1870s because I haven't written that chapter yet. But he was a composer who was completely involved in the musical fabric of New York City. He was born there in 1825. He died in 1898. He was a composer, an educator, a performer, a conductor. He wrote 5 symphonies, an opera, a major oratorio, and we don't have a biography of him, which is amazing. So there's a biography series called American Composers that the University of Illinois is publishing, and they're short biographies. They're like 120, 140 pages, and which is very different than this 600-page book I just finished. And that's what I'm working on now, and it's actually quite interesting because his music is actually quite good.
Well, I am looking forward to being able to interview you when that book comes out. Thank you so much for being with me.
All right. Thank you so much, Kristen.